Welcome back to The Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher. Before we get to tonight's topic, I'm going to give you an update on news happening on Capitol Hill right now. House impeachment manager Jamie Raskin, the congressman from Maryland, is reading the article of impeachment against former President Trump on the Senate floor.
That Donald John Trump, President of the United States, is impeached for high crimes and misdemeanors, and that the following article of impeachment be exhibited to the United States Senate.
He's accused of inciting an insurrection after his supporters stormed the U.S. Capitol building on January 6th. The Senate trial is expected to start on February 8th. That is exactly 2 weeks from to now. All of that happening at this very moment. Now back to tonight's topic. The complexities of fighting the COVID-19 pandemic in our region have become more and more difficult to manage. Even as vaccines have been made available, there just isn't enough to go around for those who want them. Restrictions across the state are different, and even from county to county and sometimes city to city. Well, tonight, we're going to talk to Montgomery County Executive Mark Elrich and County Health Officer Dr. Travis Gales about some of the latest developments concerning the COVID-19 pandemic in our region. Lines are open. If you have a comment or question about the COVID-19 pandemic in our region, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You are welcome to tweet me at HFisherWHUR. Or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Mr. County Executive and Dr. Gales, thank you both for joining this conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Absolutely. I want to start with some of the latest developments that happened today. As I'm sure you both are aware, Prince George's County Executive Angela Alsobrooks announced that only people who live or work in Prince George's County will now be able to get the COVID-19 vaccine. All of that literally changing today. Last week, it had been reported that people outside of the county and people who worked outside of the county were getting COVID-19 vaccines in Prince George's, and many of them from Montgomery County. Your reaction to this, County Executive?
The doses are apportioned to counties based on their population. And, you know, personally, I just think that, you know, counties should be as sure as you can be that the vaccines are either going to people who work there or who live there. We're interested in protecting workplaces, and if people are coming in there to work, we understand why we'd want to make sure those folks are vaccinated. But it should be primarily for people who live here in the county. So we're not advertising that if you live someplace else, you should come to Montgomery County.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Gales, can you give me a picture of the supply of vaccines in Montgomery County? Because it has, of course, been reported that, like many other places across the state and across the country, there's a shortage.
Yeah, so let's be clear. It's a shortage on a national level as well as at a state level. And because there's a shortage of supply there, thereby it bleeds down into the local jurisdictions. So when we look at the distribution in Montgomery County, we have vaccines going to different places. So at the beginning, if you recall, it started out with vaccines going directly to hospitals and nursing homes. And as the time has moved forward, a smaller percentage has gone to health departments to be able to fill in the gaps and be a safety net, if you will, for individuals who were not covered in a health system or nursing home. And as we continue to move forward in bringing in folks in the general population, particularly by age, it's becoming more important to be able to add on to the different sites where folks can get access to it. Unfortunately, as we increase the number of sites and places that people can get access to the vaccine, the one thing that hasn't changed is the capacity supply. So across the board, while we are diversifying the number of places people can get it, for example, health department supplies are getting smaller, while the state is portioning out the doses into other places. So right now in Montgomery County, for example, this week, the health department received 5,500 first doses, but we did see an influx of doses in other areas, particularly in a few of our hospitals.
Mm-hmm. When you really look at the way that the county is getting its vaccine, how short are we? If you had your druthers, how much would you need to receive per week to keep up with the demand?
Well, we wouldn't have enough because of the demand. Everybody right now is pretty high, and we'd love to get everybody covered as quickly as we can. But realistically, right now, we're looking at, you know, we've got 1.1 million people in Montgomery County, and we're averaging right now 7,000 to 8,000 doses a week. Mm. And so you simply do the math. If that is sustained on a weekly basis, it's going to take us well over a year to get everyone through the queues. Now, we have been working with the governor. We've been working with MDH to come up with some creative strategies to increase the number of doses in the county, again, through all of those different multiple contact points. And we certainly hope that that average of 7,000 to 8,000 a week can increase to upwards of 15,000 to 20,000. And certainly as we move forward and more vaccine becomes available, that number in itself will increase significantly. And we can get people coming in through droves in a quicker, more efficient manner to cover as many people as we can, as quickly as we can.
We are talking to Montgomery County Executive Mark Elridge and County Health Officer Dr. Travis Gales about the COVID crisis in Montgomery County. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810. That's 202-319-7810. Mr. County Executive, from what you understand, why is there this problem of getting the vaccines into the county? Is it, and try to be as specific as you can, is it that you're not getting it from the state, that the state is not getting it from the federal government? Is it not being made fast enough? What do you understand?
So it's not being made fast enough because, as we discovered after the former president left, there was no supply of vaccines they were holding on to. So it's not being made fast enough, number one. Whatever the federal government has, we're not sure what they have. The states aren't getting them. So the state has told us they're getting about 70,000 doses, 70 to 75,000 a week. They divide that between all of the county health systems. They get about half of it, and the other half goes to pharmacies and other groups to do vaccination. And then, Gail said, by the time we get down to the county, we're getting about 7,000 doses, and some of the other institutional, like the hospitals and the others this week, probably got about 12,000 doses. So it's not nearly enough. We've got to vaccinate people with dose one and dose two after 3 or 4 weeks, depending on what you get. And, you know, for a while, we did not know what the state had, but once we understood that the state was only sitting on this small number of doses every week, they can't get them to us any faster either. Mm-hmm. And they get their notification at the beginning of the week. They tell us, or in the middle of the week, they tell us by the end of the week what we're all going to get next Tuesday. So we get to find one week at a time what we're going to get, which makes it really hard to schedule appointments in advance. But the state is in the same box we are. So I'd start with the federal government and the failure to sign contracts for enough vaccine production or to buy enough of the vaccine production.
Mm-hmm. What about distribution? There's been a lot of talk about that as we've made the change from the Trump administration to the Biden administration. And it's very, very soon after the inauguration, obviously. So do you know whether or not there have been any changes in distribution, literally, or discussions about making that more efficient and what part that may play?
I think the state discovered that, and we all discovered, that the feds didn't have anything else to distribute. That was kind of the shocking thing. I think, yes, I know that Biden went into this thinking there was this reserved a vaccine. And then it turned out there wasn't a reserve. So, you know, Biden's been really clear. The worst is yet to come, and we're going to be months away from getting a greater supply of vaccine. It is really hard to deal with, but we're dealing with it as best we can. And I know people are impatient.
Yeah. Let me go to the phone lines, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking about the complexities of the COVID-19 pandemic in Montgomery County. My guests are Montgomery County Executive Mark Elridge and County Health Officer Dr. Travis Gales. Marie calling from Wheaton. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, thank you for having my call. I'm an educator in MCPS, and I had actually signed up to get my vaccination in PG on February 5th. That's been canceled, and I have a number of colleagues who signed up to get vaccinations who are in the 1B group are now getting turned away, especially from Quince Orchard. So I'm wondering why we are being allowed to sign up if we're going to get turned away when we actually get to the site.
Would you, either one of you gentlemen, like to try to tackle that?
Sure. I'd be happy to address that. So as a county, as we've moved forward, we've been very clear about the county apparatus moving forward with 1A and introducing 1B, including those who are over the age of 75. Our concern was that some folks may have gotten access to the link where we as a county haven't moved to the point where we are providing vaccines as part of the county apparatus to educators and teachers. So that is why we did turn individuals away. We will be announcing in the very near future, however, a strategy that will work to include teachers and provide them access to the vaccine in the very near future. We have worked with our colleagues at MCPS as well as the non-public schools, including the Association of Independent Schools, to develop a strategy to increase access at the right time, which, again, will be in the very near future.
Marie, let me make sure that we're clear about your question. You said you were being turned away. Turned away from where?
From sites. There are sites in White Oak and in Quince Orchard that allow you to sign up, and people are being turned away when they're actually at the site, not even when they skip the email. They go to get their vaccination and are being told only 1A can get their vaccination.
Go ahead, please.
So, to me, there is a problem in how the distribution system is running. So the county is, you know, even though the state has opened it up to 2B and frankly 1C, we are in actually the end of 1A and only starting 1B, which is the seniors 75 and older. Because of the way the state registration system goes or scheduling system goes, anybody who is eligible under the state's guidelines can go on there and schedule an appointment. The software is unable to make a distinction and say, in Montgomery County, you, for example, could not register for an appointment at a county-run health clinic because we're vaccinating 1A and 1B people. And we've actually had a conversation with the state about this today to see if they could fix it so that people in your group would get sent to facilities that are actually able to vaccinate people in the other groups, while the county vaccine would continue to be reserved for people 75 and older. You can imagine it's made a mess, and you've experienced it because people thought that just because the governor moved to another stage that everybody would be able to get vaccinated. But the state's been very clear that they understand that jurisdictions that haven't completed 1A and haven't completed 1B can't move into 1C.
Okay, Marie,
so you're the unfortunate victim of this.
Marie, thank you so much for your phone call. Please be safe. Let me go back to the phone lines, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Laura calling from Suitland. Laura, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Good evening, family. I just want to make a plea to everyone. Please stay in your county. Double up on your mask. wash your hands, do what Dr. Fauci asked. We already knew we didn't have enough vaccines to go around. Let it go through the process. That's all we have to do. Then everyone will be safe. Montgomery County, PG County, Fauquier County, Virginia. I'm in PG County. I am waiting to get on the list. But I'm not going to knock my seniors or people that came before me in PG County to get the vaccine. I'm going to wait my turn. I'm just asking that everyone be patient. That's all we have to do. Double up on your mask and wash your hands and stay your distance. We'll be okay.
Okay.
We can get through this. We can do.
Well, Laura, thank you so much for sharing that. I want to piggyback on what Laura was saying, a couple of things, Dr. Gales. First of all, she talked about mask doubling, and that is something that is kind of relatively new. Your thoughts about that?
Well, Laura's comments brought up a couple of things, and I think the first thing is just to emphasize to folks who are listening, listen, we from a public health perspective want to get everybody vaccinated as quickly as we can. If we had enough doses, we would get everybody vaccinated today. And I want folks to understand why we have created a prioritization framework to move one group to the next and move on that way. We've used guidance from the CDC and the Commission on Immunization Practices that have basically laid out based upon folks' risk exposure, based upon the type of work they do, what types of jobs they have, as well as the potential for having a severe response if they get COVID based upon their age and a host of other factors. So that's why we put in a process to move from one group to the next, and why we're asking folks to be as patient as possible so we can move through that quickly based upon the supply that we have. Now, even if you get the vaccine, we are still encouraging and emphasizing the rules that, or the guidelines we put into place, such as wearing face coverings and physical distancing in comparison to other folks outside your network. And as we move forward, there are new ideas and strategies coming out, for example, with the double masking that involves wearing a cloth covering that gets a good seal to cover your mouth and nose, and then having some type of medical mask over top of it to increase filtration of particles. Now, obviously, with any strategy that comes out, we've got to do our due diligence in studying it to make sure that it's efficacious and it keeps people safe. And that's where we are in the process right now. You know, this is something that's new. It's a trend that's happening. And, you know, we'll continue to study it. But at a minimum, we encourage people to wear some type of face covering that, again, covers your mouth and nose, particularly when you're around other people.
Dr. Gales, if I may interrupt you, I've got to take a really short break. Hold your point. I'll let you finish what you were saying. But I want to let our listeners know that we are going to take a very short break. Don't forget, you can hear every edition of the Daily Drum Insight segment on podcast on WHUR.com or download the 96.3 HD2 app on your smartphone and hear the program live in its entirety. John Mons is next with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. I'm Harold Fisher. This discussion continues in just a few seconds. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We are continuing our conversation with Montgomery County Executive Mark Elrich and Montgomery County Health Officer Dr. Travis Gales. We're talking about the COVID-19 pandemic, the continuing pandemic, and the challenges and complexities of fighting it. If you have a comment, if you have a question for the county executive or Dr. Gales, please give us a call. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Dr. Gales, please continue your point.
Well, actually, I was actually pretty much at the end. I was
okay.
Just saying that, with new strategies coming out, such as the double masking, we're going to continue to study it. And as we get more information, you know, we'll put that out to the general public. But at a bare minimum, you know, we still ask that people wear some type of face covering that, again, covers your mouth as well as your nose when you're around other people, whether you're indoor or outdoor.
Mm-hmm. The last time you were on the program, Mr. Elrich, you had talked about some of the challenges of dealing with businesses, restaurants and other businesses that had either been shut down or were only open at reduced capacity. And just this week, for example, just today in Prince George's, they're going to be lifting restrictions and going to 25%. How are you now addressing those difficult issues in late January? It was not an easy conversation that you had been having during the summer and fall.
That conversation hasn't gotten any easier. we are in, we discussed this a lot with the health team. And, from the beginning, I've been really clear that my goal is to keep people safe and make sure as many of us survive this encounter with the virus as possible. Our numbers are still far worse than they were when everybody decided that the best thing to do is to close everything down. And so I continue to be resistant to the notion that we should just open things back up. We know that every time we open something, we increase the risk of transmission and the risk of illness and ultimately the risk of death. And I've erred on the side of caution. Our numbers, we don't have to get to zero, but my numbers are multiples of what they were. My cases per 100,000, though they've come down, are still probably 5 to 6 times as high as they were toward the end of the summer. And our cases, our positivity rate, though it's come down, is still a couple of percentage points higher than it was during the summer. So at a point when things were, that people started opening things up, the case count started going up again. I don't want to trigger, a prolonged second wave or third wave. It's hard to count the waves right now. By opening things up and increasing the possibility of spread, we're going through a period of getting vaccinated. Vaccines are going to take some of the pressure off and all this. As our case counts come down, we get to a place where we think it's manageable. We'll move toward reopening some things in a limited way. But despite people who think, we should do this right now, I don't feel like it's the right time. And, Dr. Gales, free to chime in on this.
Dr. Gales?
Well, I think as the county executive referenced, I mean, this speaks to a delicate balance that has been present throughout the pandemic in terms of trying to balance public health risk factors and concerns with economics. And unfortunately, somewhere along the line, the environment created a dynamic where those two were pitted against each other. But I'll be very clear, those of us in the public health world completely understand and sympathize with those who have been impacted adversely from an economic standpoint, which is pretty much everybody due to the pandemic. But we'll continue to monitor the trends and be able to tweak the things we have open versus closed as we continue to move forward looking at the data over the coming days and over the next week or so.
I wanted to ask you, and I'm almost sure you have this data, Dr. Gales. As we know, the coronavirus does not understand borders, whether those borders are geographical or they are, borders from one room to another in a house. But where are you seeing the biggest surges in the county, and why do you believe that is?
Well, we continue to see pretty much, unfortunately, some of the same zip codes throughout the county that have been hit hardest from the very early stages of the pandemic and continuing through the course of the last 10 months since we got our first case. And we think of a host of different factors that weigh into that. One, it's the fact that even though many people have had the opportunity to work from home and telework, there's still a lot of people who we require to go out and be our first-line workers and responders to keep our economy open and to keep things moving. And we recognize that a lot of those folks, unfortunately, are likely to be exposed because they're coming out and working every day and then going back home. We know that there are factors in terms of, how many folks live in a housing space that makes it easier to transmit from person to person, as you mentioned, within a household. And that speaks to you know, some underlying issues in terms of housing affordability. How is it that we have such a large number of folks in such a small space? And I think some of the other factors, there are two things that we talked about over the course of the pandemic in the last several months, is the notion of COVID fatigue, where some people are just kind of, you know, tired, and they may slack off in terms of adhering to the guidelines that have kept them safe throughout. And then there's the other concept of kind of risk perception. You know, I think there's some people who say, well, you know, I may be in a younger age group, or, you know, if I get it, I'm probably not going to have as bad of a case, so I'm less likely to adhere again to the guidelines that have been put into place, and more likely to potentially take part in some riskier activities that may predispose them to come into contact with the virus.
Last week, Governor Hogan once again urged county school systems to open, and he wanted them to open by March. And he and Dr. Karen Salmon were talking about the low risk of community spread with children. Do you agree with that, County Executive Elridge? Why or why not?
Well, I'm concerned about, you know, a couple of things. One is there's a lot of, you know, they focus on the children, but they don't talk about the teachers. And, you know, there's evidence that teachers, in fact, do get sick, and that a lot of our teachers are in the older age cohorts, the ones that are most likely to have bad outcomes if they get sick. So I think you've got to think about everybody who's put into the school. We are working toward vaccinating the teachers who are most likely to come back soonest. And we're working with the school system on a plan to do this. Vaccinating them, I think, would relieve, you know, one area of great concern. But, you know, I continue to be concerned about the fact that children can get COVID and be asymptomatic. And so if the notion of community spread is based on contact tracing, where you find the person who you identified with COVID and then you try to trace back to who they had contact with, well, if the kids in a classroom, for example, are asymptomatic, and you go back and look and say, well, did anybody in this classroom, you know, show COVID? And if nobody in the classroom actually was identified as having COVID, you could miss a carrier, and therefore you could miss a contact. And so I think there are some challenges doing contact tracing when it involves children, unless you're actually going to go out and test all of the children in the class to see if they had it in the class. So I prefer to be a little bit more careful. I feel better with the vaccines going out. I feel better with the schools working on making the classroom safer by dealing with the air exchanges inside the classroom and by sticking to, I know they're going to have a set of very strict rules on how a classroom has to be operated. I think we'll get there. I think everybody wants to get there. Look, I'm a former elementary school teacher. I have great empathy for any elementary school teacher that's trying to teach by Zoom. My days involve going around and talking to people, talking to the kids and working with them. And you can't do that with Zoom. These are not high school students or junior high students. So I appreciate the difficulty of it. We just want to make sure that everybody's as safe as possible.
Dr. Gales, I wanted to share something anecdotal with you. Over the weekend, a dear friend of mine had to go to Holy Cross Hospital for a non-COVID related illness. And one of the things that she shared with me was that Holy Cross was on a red, yellow, green system. And I suspect that isn't just Holy Cross. It may be every hospital in the county, if not in the state. And she also said that because of the pandemic, Holy Cross specifically had, you know, they were converting closets into rooms where they could put patients who may not have had any illnesses related to COVID. My first question is, are you familiar with this red, yellow, green COVID light system? And if so, can you share what that means?
Sure. So the red, yellow, green system actually isn't specific to COVID per se, but it gives us it's a system that hospitals use to assess their level of capacity and fullness. And so when it gives us a sense of how many beds they have available. Now, it's taken on added importance in the COVID world because the hospital numbers have been high for so long and sustained over a long period of time. And the state uses that system to kind of approximate to say, you know, how do we set off triggers in terms of the hospital needing to create more space to take care of patients? Whether that's creating more physical space, hiring more staff, or, you know, repurposing space that they have and moving patients around so that they can have adequate resources and space to take care of patients in general, but also the sicker patients who may need a higher level of care. And so we, in addition to all of the community transmission levels that we look at, including, you know, test positivity, our case rates, those kind of things, we also keep a very close eye out on the hospital utilization rates, because we certainly don't want to have a system where you see in other places such as Los Angeles right now, where they've run out of space, they don't have enough space to take care of patients, and they're having to make hard decisions about who gets a hospital bed, who gets a ventilator, and who gets diverted to another place because they simply don't have the capacity to take care of them. Right now, our hospitals, they did a great job in the early stages of the pandemic coming up with a surge playbook, and they're continuing to use those strategies that were thought out that we worked with them on, as well as working with the state to develop. And I think right now a couple of them are in that red zone, but we're holding strong and hoping that the numbers trend back downward so that we can see more space open in the hospitals to take care of not only COVID patients, but anyone else who actually needs services and critical care.
Dr. Gales, I'm assuming you've had a vaccine?
Yes, I have. Yes.
How do you feel? What did you have? What did you have, as a matter of fact?
Yes. So I actually completed the Moderna vaccine series. I got the first dose on December 23rd, a couple days before Christmas. After the first dose, I didn't really have any side effects. And then I received the second dose on last Wednesday. And other than a little bit of a sore arm at the injection site, I didn't have any, you know, fatigue, chills, or any, you know, secondary side effects. I feel fine otherwise so far, thankfully.
So I ask you that specifically because you're a black man, and we have seen, and this isn't a Montgomery County thing, this isn't a Maryland thing, this is a thing, that many people in the black and brown communities are still giving a lot of skeptical pushback. And to be quite honest, I've been receiving in my social media inboxes a torrent of don't take the vaccine postings. And it is concerning to me because, and I'd like to hear your thoughts about it, because I'm wondering what impact this kind of pushback is having on trying to get through this, particularly for communities of color.
Harold, I think we could do a whole radio show on that topic alone. But to try to be succinct, so first and foremost, yes, it's important that our communities get the vaccine. Our communities have been hit the hardest, both in terms of the number of cases as well as the COVID-related fatalities. And so, you know, apples to apples, when you look at it, here is a vaccine and an opportunity to provide significant protection from contracting COVID. And even if the small percentage chance that you would get COVID, it would significantly decrease the severity of the illness compared to if you don't have it. And so part of it is, I think we have to have a larger conversation about why that skepticism is in place. Now, we know generally and broadly there's a lot of concern about the vaccine due to the time frame within which it was brought onto market and it was approved. And that's not just in black and brown communities, but we're seeing that particularly even in healthcare workers. We're not seeing as high of an uptake in those communities. And a lot of people are taking a wait and see approach. I know all of my family members were like, so we're going to watch you get it. And if you get it and it goes well, that's what we need, you know, in terms of confirmation that it's okay to move forward. But I think we do need to have a larger conversation. You know, I know a lot of people reference the historical perspectives of public health in terms of the Tuskegee experiment. But quite frankly, we don't have to go that far back to see why there's reasons of mistrust in terms of delivery of services and delivery of health care that is disproportionately, again, affecting and impacting communities of color. But what I would say is this. The vaccines were moved through. They are safe. They've been studied in a traditional sense. They're efficacious. They provide great protection. It is important to get it because, again, it is going to be offering a significant level of protection for our communities that have been hit so hard. When you look across the country, when we see who's dying from this disease and who's having the highest sense of morbidity. So I implore and plead with folks in the Black community and other communities, please take a serious look at the information. It is safe. It is efficacious. It does provide great protection. And it really will be a tremendous key to protecting us as we move forward from this from COVID-19.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. So what is the next big step from your perspective, Mr. Elrich? We've talked about schools, we've talked about this distribution, and we've talked about the one A, B, and C. From your perspective, what's in the plan moving forward?
I think the entirety of the plan rests on the ability to get vaccines. Until we get enough people vaccinated, or on the grimmer side, until enough people get sick who aren't vaccinated, so the combination of them, of the two of those groups gives us something approximating herd immunity, we are going to have to struggle to keep this under control. And so, for me, I'm looking at making sure we have the maximum ability to get vaccines out. I am lobbying at the federal level. I mean, the truth is, if we had had the courage in the beginning just to close everything for 6 or 8 weeks and just make sure the businesses were made whole and unemployed people were made whole in terms of being able to pay the rent and meet their bills, we would be in a way better position today than we are, because the vaccine, it requires human beings to transmit it. And if the human beings aren't transmitting the vaccine, I mean, not the vaccine, but the virus dies. It's not like a bacteria, which can live like Legionnaire's disease for months or years in the ductwork. It's got this virus has limited lifetime. And if it doesn't get spread to another human being to pass it along, it goes away. So my goal is to keep us as safe as possible. We are, we're making plans. We're trying to figure out in our budget what's going to be open in June, if we can make any guesses about that, what it's going to look like in the fall. But there's, everything we do is going to be contingent on where we are in terms of managing the virus. That's the unfortunate part about all of this. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Gales, President Biden has talked about a dark winter. He talked a lot about that pre-inauguration and those kinds of sentiments continue. From your perspective, what do you hear when he says that, and what does it mean to you?
Well, I think he and his administration are level setting expectations for folks. I think we experience an extreme dearth of high quality factual information over the course of the last year, pretty much, in terms of information being shared with the public. And I think they're just being real to level set expectations, particularly as it relates, for example, we've shared that the vaccine is kind of a light at the end of the tunnel. It's going to take us a little bit longer to get to a point where, again, we don't have to have these conversations about prioritizing one group or the other. We can just say it's open for everybody. Call your doctor, call your provider, go to a Giant, go to the pharmacy, go to the health department where people can get the vaccine. And I think that's important. Because that helps, I think, when the level of truth and sincerity behind providing fact-based information, I think, helps address the anxiety that many folks have around waiting for the vaccine and waiting, many, all of us, waiting for a point where we can return to some sense of normalcy in our lives, whether it's opening up businesses, opening up schools, opening up travel, and making sure that everybody's safe in doing so.
Is there enough testing in the county right now? Are you, Dr. Gales, satisfied with where the county is regarding testing?
Yes. Testing is something that we have done, I think, a fairly good job on in the county. We have achieved mitigation levels of testing throughout, whether it's including our county testing sites. And we're thankful for all of the different community groups and government agencies that have partnered together to create a multifaceted framework that's accessible across the county, as well as healthcare providers. And we've created a system that allows for quick access to testing, and fortunately, the labs have improved their turnaround times. So folks can get tested, whether they're, you know, symptomatic or they're concerned about an exposure or they'd like to know their status, and get their results in a timely manner. Effective access to testing is critical to identifying cases at an early stage that allows us to remove them from networks of transmission to keep the potential number of other cases that come, other folks that they come into contact with and potentially infect.
Mr. Elridge, you, I'm sure you remember the extremely expressive lady who called the last time you were on the program saying that the pandemic was not real, that and that she said she was a pharmaceuticals in pharmaceutical sales, and that the hospitals have plenty of room and the like. I've given that phone call quite a bit of thought, you know, considering the muscular pushback that I've given her. Are you not still concerned that there are people who believe that this thing is not real? And what impact does that have, not only from your position in leadership, but just, you know, more generally as a citizen?
Well, it complicates our ability to get better. If people don't believe it's real and they're willing to put themselves, their children, their families, and everybody else at risk, this is not helpful to our efforts to control this. And I worry about it just in terms of, I'm amazed at how many people, you know, listen to a Twitter or listen to some of these crazy feeds from groups. You know, they're anti-vaccine. They think this is some fiendish plot by the Chinese, or, you know, pick your government, pick your bad actor, and are totally just ignoring all the scientific evidence that, you know, says this is real. People get sick. I don't know how you ignore the deaths. I guess they just say people are going to die anyway, so what's the difference? There's a callousness about this that really bothers me. And then there are those people who I think on the extreme end of this are just, you know, almost like they're Darwinistic about it. It's like, well, you know, if you're sick and you have pre-existing condition, why should the rest of us have to put up with these restrictions? It's just unfortunate. It would be a lot better if, you know, we as a society just grasp the fact that we're in the midst of a major threat to our health and safety, and that we all need to be working together to minimize the harm that is done to the people around us and to our loved ones, and ultimately it would actually help putting you at less risk. So I get frustrated, and it doesn't end.
Yeah. Dr. Gales, one thing I wanted to definitely ask you. You said that you wanted to see all county residents as much as possible completely vaccinated within 2 years. Is that realistic? Do you think that is truly possible?
Well, let me correct you. I would love to see them all vaccinated as soon as possible. Hopefully it does not take us 2 years to do it. I think the 2 years was if we keep on pace with the number of doses we're getting on a weekly basis now, it would take nearly 2 years to get everybody covered. I think the next 100 days will determine, I think, how we move forward. both in terms of increased production of the vaccines that we have out now, including Moderna and Pfizer. There's also promise that we may have other vaccines coming through that would be good candidates. For example, there is one that we're awaiting information on from the phase three trials for a one-dose vaccine. You know, those are the kinds of things that would be significant game changers. And if we can get the productivity level up and we can get those doses out, I think that changes our conversation from saying, you know, we're getting 7,000 a week to we can get thousands upon thousands of doses out quickly and move through these groups really fast and get as many people covered as possible as quickly as we can.
Mr. County Executive, final thoughts from you?
I guess I keep trying to tell people to be patient and not to, you know, let up in the way that people have protected themselves. I mean, I'm impressed when I go around the county and the region, frankly, and see how many people are actually masking up and doing what we expect them to do. But I also hear a lot about fatigue and people just so badly wanting to go back to normal that they don't know if they can keep doing this. And I feel like, you know, we've come almost a year now. And if we've gotten through a year and you know the vaccines are here and you know that sometime in the not too distant future, we will be able to move this behind us. I just ask people to be patient and continue to stick with it. And no, it's not fun. And yes, you know, I'm not going to the movies I want to go to or out to listen to the bands or out to dinner or any of the stuff that I really enjoy. But I also know that if I do this and everybody else does this, that we're going to wind up out of this sooner than later, and that more of us will be around to be with each other when this is all over. So patience, patience, patience.
Yeah, and hopefully we don't see more patience as we all struggle through this, because we certainly are in this together. Montgomery County Executive Mark Elrich and County Health Officer Dr. Travis Gales, thank you so much for sharing with us tonight. We really appreciate your time, and as always, please be safe.
Thank you.
That is the Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141 for this Monday, January 25th, 2021. I'm Harold Fisher. Now, stay tuned for Unheard with Wes Hall. Good night.